Before I start, let me plug next week's lecture, which is by Elton Barker from the Open University and Leif Isaksen from Southampton. And it's called Mind the Gap, Finding Ancient Places in the Google Books Corpus, and sounds very interesting. So do come to that if you can. But without further ado, let me introduce this week's speaker. Timothy Pill works for the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at NYU. And we'll be talking on semantics and semantic constructs in cultural comparison. Now, for those who have read through the little blurb, one little phrase caught my attention. That is, he wants to free the historian, as in us, from a reflexive bind. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I will listen to anyone who wants to deliver us from any reflexive bind or any bind. So thank you very much, Timothy Hill.
Thank you. I'd like to start off with three apologies. The first is that I'm going to be talking about things very, very ridiculously broadly for the next 45 minutes or so. So I'm going to be eliding a lot of distinctions that people will probably think are quite vital when it touches upon their particular area of expertise. That's partly because I am talking very theoretically, so to a certain extent I'm deliberately ignoring those distinctions. It's also partly because I wasn't too sure of the audience who were going to be coming. It's sometimes hard to balance technical and historical and scholarly concerns appropriately. So at various points I'm going to be skimming over things that experts are going to realize are actually quite crucial. The second apology I'd like to make is that this paper is to a certain extent attempting to discuss the Roman Empire in late antiquity as a whole. However, when I get down to specific examples, I'm going to be talking pretty much just about the western part of the empire, and specifically mostly about Britain. And that's really just because in terms of digital scholarship, that's the stuff that I've got most readily accessible to me and that I'm most familiar with, and partly because I'm happier working in Latin than in Greek. So when I'm thinking about these things, Latin is fairly straightforward for me. My third apology is that all of these ideas that I'm going to be presenting are ideas that I have been kicking around for about the last 6 months or so, and they have all at various points been very thoroughly and soundly rejected by people. I have actually been astonished at the degree of hostility that some of the things I'm about to say has aroused in the people I've been bouncing them off, particularly given that basically this paper is going to be about database mediation, which is not normally the kind of topic that really gets the blood boiling. So anyway, I'm going to run these by you again, and if you find them intensely irritating, I'm sure we'll have a chance to canvass those opinions afterwards. I just said that this was about database mediation. Actually, I probably should have said data store, because I think there's a sense in which, because I'm talking so abstractly, it doesn't really matter what kind of format things are stored in. The point is really that some kind of electronic resource needs to be somehow joined up with some other kind of electronic resource. Relational DB, or something encoded in with linked data, or even just some kind of structured data store would all be relevant to what I'm about to say. The reason I'm saying this now is that we are getting, despite funding cuts and so forth, an increasing number of digital data stores coming online. There's more and more data of relevance to historians coming online all the time. These databases are themselves getting larger as well. We've got more and they're getting bigger. And I think we are potentially looking at a situation in maybe the next 10 to 15 years of running into problems of gluing them all together. Right now, I don't know if scholars are using databases in a way that really is going to bring the questions that I'm about to be discussing to the forefront, but if linked data and the semantic web get off the ground a little more than they currently are, I think we're going to have to think very hard about the issues that I'm going to be discussing. The basic problem is the incompatibility of data schemas or data models or data schemata. This might sound slightly technical, but the concept is very simple. When you're entering information into a database, you have to structure that information in some way in order to be able to retrieve it from the database again and link it up with other items in the database. So this is just something that I sort of made up, really. This would be an example of a data model. If you're recording, say, Roman military personnel that you find attested on inscriptions, you need to decide what kind of things you're going to record about the personnel and about the inscription when you stick them into the database. So here I've got name, rank, age at death, unit attached to, inscription location, and inscription date. Not a very sophisticated data model, but it would at least be a start. And for every personnel that you find, you're going to have to enter that data in. You've decided that you're going to enter that kind of data in. In addition, in your data model, you probably decide what kind of values are appropriate to enter into each of these fields. So for the location of the inscription, you're going to have to decide whether you're going to work with GPS coordinates, whether you're going to designate it in terms of the settlement that it's been found by, the province it's been found in, and so on and so forth. Very often you'll have some kind of controlled vocabulary. So you'll have a list of, say, Roman military ranks that you're going to select. And you're not going to admit other text strings that you might find as valid military ranks. Now, this kind of concern for data model is not confined to digital or electronic mediation. Pretty much any textual reference work is going to have some kind of data model, either implicitly implicit in it or explicitly asserted about it. So if you look at something like the Prosopographia Imperii Romani, they've made possession of a certain level of social rank, the criterion for inclusion. So everybody that you find in it is going to be, you know, a senator or above. And things like name, gens, and that kind of thing are going to be recorded about every individual for whom information exists in the PIR. And of course, this is true to some extent to any attempt to present information. You're going to have to structure it in some way before it becomes comprehensible to the audience. The problem is that computers are much stricter about how you formalize these things, of course, and they will just simply come shuddering to a halt if you don't do it in the correct way. So these are questions that are forefronted digitally, but are present throughout the scholarly enterprise. And the difficulty, of course, is that it's possible legitimately to have different views about what the appropriate data model for a domain happens to be. The reasons for this could stem from, say, theoretical differences about how you're approaching the area. It could be questions about lack of information. It could be pragmatic questions about why you're storing the information and what you're hoping to learn from it, and so on and so forth. One sort of very simple example of differences in data model creating problems is, to stay with the example we've got here of Roman military personnel, in the 2nd century AD you start getting this proliferation of, or apparent proliferation of ranks in the Roman army. You start getting people like Ballistarii and Lanciarii and Scorpionarii attested in inscriptions that you didn't tend to find earlier on. And so there was a question that immediately arises from this of who these people are. You know, where do they fit into the Roman military hierarchy? And research was done on this absolutely ages ago, and it was established that in most cases, these new military titles don't represent new ranks. It's really just more specialized labels for jobs that were already being done in the army. So you start characterizing soldiers in terms of the kinds of weapons that they bear rather than referring to them generically as milites or peditati or something like that. The scholarly consensus seems to be that most of these new titles don't reflect new realities. They're simply new labels for people in the army. But despite the fact that this change is in a sense more apparent than real based on inscriptional evidence, you do end up into a real problem of data design if you start putting this stuff in a database, because if you're working on, say, the Roman army in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, and you look for all the milites or peditati that you have attested throughout that period, they're going to suddenly disappear about the middle of the 2nd century. And of course, this isn't because suddenly the Roman army shrank or anything like that, it's simply because the terminology changed. So you need to have some kind of mechanism in place, if you're storing this, to make sure that when people are looking for milites, they actually get all of the various subclasses of the militia that grew up in this time, rather than simply zero hits, a false negative. Obviously, this is a problem that arises all over the place in digital data stores, and there are lots of solutions to it. I'm going to focus on one known as the Simple Knowledge Organization System. The reason I'm doing this is partly because I think the kinds of constructs that SCoS offers, for reasons that I'll go into shortly, are those that most historians and scholars would find useful. And the other reason I'm using it for the sake of example is that even though, as you can see, it's a little on the verbose side, it's actually fairly readable. For the sake of example, I've assumed that we've got two online databases, one of which is concerned with the early empire or Julio Claudians or something, and the other of which is concerned with the high empire. One of them defines ranks as they are found in the 1st century AD, and the other one defines ranks as they are found in the 2nd century AD. So that's what this little bit means. It's just saying things with this prefix, early empire, come from this data store, things with this prefix come from that data store, and things with these prefixes are
constructs used for web mediation. Once you've established that, you can sort of read this a little bit like a sentence in SCOS. Early Empire database term peditatus is a concept which has the English label foot soldier. High Empire database balistarius is also a concept. It has the label artilleryman in English. And it has a broader term in the Early Empire database, peditatus, which is a complicated way of saying that this is a broad concept that encompasses this narrower concept. And you get the same thing down here. Scorpionarius is also an artilleryman in English. And here a linkage is made saying that this is the same thing as a balistarius, which is strictly speaking not true. They operate different kinds of artillery, apparently. But for certain purposes, you could consider them to be the same kind of thing. And if you make this kind of assertion, you're simply saying, I am going to be treating these as the same kind of thing for the purposes of my database query. So it is kind of legible, or at least compared to other forms of data store mediation, it's kind of legible. So all you're really doing in terms of mediation is saying what things can be considered to be other things. You know, when things are the same, and if, and using refinements in the vocabulary, you could specify more clearly and more precisely in what sense you consider them to be the same. So that basically is the nuts and bolts of data store mediation. Now obviously things can get just hellaciously more complicated than this. And if they get really, really hellaciously complicated and you start building up a really big structure, you can start getting into what's called an ontology, which aims to be a complete vocabulary that describes every aspect of the domain that you're interested in talking about in a consistent way. I think computer scientists would argue with the implication that an ontology is really just a big kind of data mediation, but anyway, for the purposes of today's discussion, that's what it is. There are quibbles about how exactly you define an ontology, but the kind of classic definition is this one from Thomas Gruber back in 1995. An ontology is an explicit specification of a conceptualization. So if you're trying to describe the domain, you have to do so in an explicit way and in a specific way, and you have to have some idea what the domain is, which sounds fairly self-evident. I think there's two points worth bearing in mind with this definition. The first is that the question of the conceptualization is kind of off the stage in this definition. It's logically prior to the ontology, and ontologists tend not to talk about how you get to the conceptualization. It's kind of a given in the situation. The second is that there's actually a certain degree of reflexivity implied in this definition. By which I mean an ontologist is typically concerned only, as the rest of the definition goes on to say, with making sure that the conceptualization is logical, that it's something that can be reasoned over. The assumption in the literature, and if you look at ontological methodologies like Ontoclean, seems to be that you have a conceptualization, which is this kind of fuzzy ball, and the ontologist comes and tidies it up and makes it logical and formalizes it in such a way that it is rigid and self-consistent and can be used computationally. And there's not really much acknowledgement made that there's a good possibility, in fact, a very strong possibility, that the way that you formalize it and the way that you specify it is going to actually alter the original nature of the conceptualization. The idea seems to be just that things are kind of a bit ill-defined, and then when you actually write them down and conceptualize them, that you've somehow more fully expressed what the conceptualization was. However, I think we've probably all had this experience where once you formalize something, you realize that you weren't saying what you thought you were saying, or that you are now saying something you didn't actually originally intend to say. So there's this very slight degree of a sense in which ontologizing something changes its original nature. I don't want to push that too far, but I think it's useful bearing in mind. And having just said that, I'm going to now more or less leave this behind, because what I'm going to be talking about really is conceptualization.
I'm not going to be talking too much about how we specify these conceptualizations. That's something for ontologists to do. I'm going to be talking really about how we get to a concept using ontological concepts, but without talking about it in an ontological frame. So that was tremendously unclear. The problem, I think, is that in humanities questions and in classics questions, very often the degree of reflexivity between the conceptualization and the specification is very, very high in a way that is not acknowledged in ontological methodologies. Insofar as humanities questions are research questions and not archiving questions or access questions, a lot of problems arise because it is not just a question of getting the data. The problems that humanities people tend to face are, in fact, problems of conceptualization, sometimes caused or caused by the way in which the conceptualization is specified or fails to be specified. And this is an intrinsic characteristic of humanities research, I think. This isn't a problem necessarily that needs to be solved. I think this is just characteristic of the kinds of questions that humanities people tend to ask. And so the question is not how can we somehow get to conceptualizations that can be specified in an ontologically satisfactory way. It's a question of how do we negotiate with conceptualizations and how do we use them in such a way that they answer the kinds of questions that scholars and classicists are interested in asking. That is probably not much clearer than the first formulation I gave you. And indeed, every time I've started talking like this to colleagues around the CCH, I've been told that I've been talking too abstractly. So I'm now going to go into a sort of case study, trying to flesh out a little bit of what I mean by this. I'm going to be talking specifically about late antiquity. The reason I find this period useful to talk about in this context is that it's of absolutely crucial historical importance. It's the fall of the Roman Empire, right, which everybody is interested in. It's simultaneously the birth of most of the nation states that make up modern day Europe come out of this period. It attracts a lot of attention in what might be considered pop historiography. Nevertheless, it's not popular with historians. It falls between periodizations. So you've got classics departments and you've got history departments with medieval subsections. But late antiquity lives in a kind of difficult interim there. We've got the medieval world, which we think we can we're comfortable with. We've got the classical world, which we're comfortable with. And you'd think this would generate an immense amount of interest in how you get from one to the other. You've got two knowns. The unknown is in the middle. The reaction seems to be exactly the opposite, that you flee to either end of this spectrum. Or as one lecturer to me as an undergraduate put it when I said that I was interested in late antiquity, he said, well, that's all very well unless you want a job. It's quite cute assuming there would be jobs in classics and history, but anyway. And I think the late antique historiography is complicated by the fact that because the fall of the Roman Empire does have such a presence in pop historiography, and it has had such a sort of historical, such a huge role in the historical imagination in Europe over the last 500 years, as one late antiquity historian has written, the fall of the Roman Empire has had the misfortune to be a potent symbol that has been reinterpreted through every idée fixe of every decade and every national group in the last two centuries or longer. So often in place of sort of large empirically based studies of the period, you get sort of large, huge theoretical ideas that are held to somehow encompass the fall of the Roman Empire without much need to actually look at the facts on the ground. So, you know, everything from lead pipes to barbarian incursions to whatever can be held to be the cause of this. So you get a lot of airy abstractions without a lot of connections to what the actual data. And this is something that's been pointed out by two historians of late antiquity recently. I'm thinking specifically of Peter Brown and Chris Wickham, both of whom have sort of written slightly snarky paragraphs saying, you know, we actually do have enough data now to start creating some kind of synthesis. It's time to clear out a lot of the theory and also to stop focusing on very, very narrow regional specializations and try to create some kind of larger synthesis. Both of them have sort of said that they're about to do this. And they both agree that the question is going to have to proceed by sort of broad comparison and holistic overview of the period as a whole, more than by focusing on, say, the history of Rome as a city or something like that. I'm going to be focusing in particular for the discussion on urban change. This is a change from what I wrote in my abstract, I admit, which was about the role of bishops. That's because as soon as I started looking at the role of bishops, I realized it was a really, really interesting question. And it was actually too interesting a question. You have to start answering questions about the nature of religion, all sorts of nasty, incredibly vexed and highly abstract questions have to be answered before that becomes kind of a useful way of looking at it. Whereas the question of urban decline in late antiquity is basically a socioeconomic question. It should, in principle, be answerable with hard, cold facts like economics, political positions, and so on and so forth. It's the kind of thing that, in theory, you could suck information out of a database and get an answer to. There's also been a lot more information on urban history that's been discovered lately. There's been a lot of archaeology in the area and so on and so forth. So it does seem possible that in the near future, somebody with an interest in urban history during late antiquity might start needing to mediate between a lot of databases to try to get a holistic picture. It's an undeniably important question. The civilization of the Roman Empire and the Hellenistic oikoumene before it is thoroughly urban in character. So there's a sense in which characterizing changes in urban living over the period of late antiquity serve to paint a larger picture of what's going on with the empire as a whole. And because of this, there's a very long tradition of scholarship that attempts to look at urban change over this period. And this brings me to my chief reason for focusing on urban change rather than bishops, which is simply that recent scholarship has actually summarized last 75 or 80 years of scholarship of urbanity in late antiquity, meaning that I didn't have to do any original research. I could just take it all out of Chris Wickham's book. So I'm going to be going over known ground here, but I'm going to hold off for a moment on the summary of what Wickham has to say about urban change in late antiquity, just to propose a sort of thought experiment. Saying, well, suppose you are somebody who's interested in the nature of urban change in late antiquity. Supposing you want to do some very basic, very fundamental research into it and try to get a very sort of data-centric perspective on what's going on during this period. And because of the enormous amount of information involved and the amount of facts available, you're going to be doing this at least partially through database queries. What do you do? In a sense, this is a good time to be asking the question, because we do, in fact, have a fair amount of information in databases that would help you answer it, and is becoming more and more accessible. Here's a few of the resources you might use. Pleiades is a very useful resource. This is started off as basically the Barrington Atlas online. It'll give you names, lats, and longs of pretty much every location mentioned in our ancient sources and archaeologically, I believe. There's some stuff in there too. It'll also give you interconnections between those points, so you can go to a city, find out what river it's on, follow that river down, find the next city down the river, and so on and so forth. It's a tremendous resource. And on top of this, Google Ancient Places has been building things with Pleiades. And if you show up next week, you can find out more about that. Google Ancient Places is interesting because that correlates texts and textual references to places with the actual locations on the maps. So you could say, you know, give me everywhere that's mentioned in Livy, navigate to the point on the map that's mentioned in Livy, and then say, get me all the textual references to this point in other authors that have been digitized in Google Books. So it's possible to trace in very fine-grained detail information about geographical locales using GAP. Well, it will shortly be. There's not actually enough text digitized yet to really do everything that a really serious researcher would want, but they're obviously moving in that direction. And then there's a variety of other databases that are available. Prosopography of the Byzantine Empire is available on CD-ROM, Prosopography of Anglo-Saxon England,
from the CCH, something called Regnum Francorum Online, which seems to be still in a state of development. The Medieval and Renaissance Italy Prosopographical Database has just started up. So there's a lot of stuff out there. So how do you start navigating through this? Well, your first step, I suppose, I should say that the problem typically is not a problem with any of these resources. These resources are all on their own terms very easy to navigate, and they're all very concerned to make sure that they don't interpose a lot of mediation between you and the original source material. With regard to the geographical projects, their periodizations, their point geometry, and so on and so forth are unproblematic. With regard to the other databases, which are mostly about storing texts or drawing information out of texts, you can always get back to the source text very, very easily. When they use or create their own categories, they tend to tie them in very, very closely with the text. So by and large, your access to the original data store is pretty bare and pretty raw and exactly what you'd want if you're a researcher interested in primary sources. So the technical layer is pretty much transparent. But that just means that the cultural and historical difficulties and linguistic difficulties that you're going to run into are that much more obvious. For instance, your first step would probably be to select from all of the features that are recorded in Pleiades and Google Ancient Places. You want to make sure that you're only focusing on those that are actually urban settlements, right? You're not writing a history of rivers and waterfalls. And this is a problem. How do you decide which ones are cities and which ones are other kinds of geographical features? Because this is not information that is recorded in GAP or Pleiades. Your first thought, if you're textually minded, would probably be, well, I'll line these things up with the textually minded databases, and GAP is partly that, and get all the things that are referred to as, say, civitates or urbes. Seems pretty straightforward, right? And with appropriate little bits of natural language processing, you could easily say, get every feature that was mentioned, or every geographical entity that was collocated closely with urbs or civitas could be brought out of the mix. That would be fairly straightforward. And at first glance, this would seem to work pretty well. If you just decided to eliminate everything that wasn't referred to as a civitas or an urbs, the usual suspects would turn up. Rome, Constantinople, Carthage, these would all show up in your results set. Lots and lots of things would disappear. You wouldn't have to worry about lakes and so on and so forth. So you would pass an initial sanity check. But when you looked a little closer, you discover that civitas and urbs are actually not terribly useful terms for you. Particularly once you get into the northern part of empire. In the later empire, civitas, right, is a Roman administrative division that gets taken over by the church. So if you're looking at Britannia, a lot of civitates are really not much more than a cathedral with maybe a monastery attached to it or something like that, which is fine. It might be what you want, but it's certainly difficult to compare that straight on with a city defined in the classical sense of the word. And in fact, this is still a problem. I mean, I was talking to somebody on the weekend who was from Glastonbury, and her husband was nagging at her because he was from Wells, which apparently is the only city in Somerset, precisely because it has a cathedral, right? So you get a lot of false positives. You'd end up with too many civitates in Britannia. And you'd also get a lot of false negatives. For instance, London for a while would disappear because that's not a civitas. It's a significant settlement, but it doesn't have a cathedral. So what do you do? You might decide to drop civitas. You might say, well, just give me the urbes then. But then you end up dropping too much out. You lose York briefly. Which is a bit peculiar in the context of Britannia, and simply because writers tend to refer to it as a civitas at certain points, and because our sources also get much narrower or much fewer during this period, suddenly little linguistic accidents like that become much, much more crucial. If you then attempt to compensate, however, by broadening your linguistic net, by including the vernacular would be an obvious step, or by including a wider range of Latin terms, suddenly you get too many false positives again. For instance, in the UK, it would make sense to start looking for things with the wic suffix, right?
And it would also make sense to look for things referred to as mercimonia. And this is good because it captures significant post-Roman settlements. You get London reappears again because it's Londonwick, or the Saxon version of London is Londonwick. You also get Hamwick, which for early medieval historians of Britain is a very important site, basically Southampton now. But again, it's a little bit tricky to say that something referred to as a mercimonium should be considered a city, because even though the populations are large and there's a great deal of commercial activity focused on them, they don't have a very large permanent population. So again, what you're getting to by using these terms is not necessarily an urban settlement of the type that you're thinking of when you're trying to chart urban decline as an index of the decline of the empire as a whole. It seems a little incongruous to lump in Hamwick and Londonwick with Carthage at the same period. So what you're doing here is sort of iterating over and over again over various ways that you could specify what it is that you're looking for. And as you continually do this, you will be refining your sense of both linguistic knowledge, what kind of words you need to characterize the kinds of things you're looking for, and what kind of features are actually associated with these terms. So you're slowly possibly getting closer to a better understanding of what it is about urbanism you're actually trying to study. And there's a very strong possibility, of course, that you're going to discover that really the problem is your original conception of urbanism is not adequate to the question that you were trying to answer. And of course this grows very complex. You can keep doing this for the province or the ex-province of Britannia and keep on narrowing your search terms, refining what it is you're looking for. And of course, if you're looking at the empire as a whole, you're going to have to do this for every province of the empire. So it's going to get horrendously, horrendously complicated. Fortunately, essentially 3 or 4 generations of scholars have basically already done that. And fortunately, an overview of these last 3 or 4 generations of this kind of iterative process have been summarized, as I said, by Chris Wickham in a fairly recent book. And a kind of tentative solution has been advanced by him. And it's actually pretty basic. Because some time ago, back in 1976, an Anglo-Saxon historian named Martin Biddle came up with a criterion mundell for what kinds of things are required to qualify as an urban settlement in Anglo-Saxon England during, say, the 5th to 6th centuries. And his view was that you needed 3 or 4 of these things to qualify properly as an urban settlement. And Wickham, Mutatis Mutandis, kind of uses these categories to survey the empire as a whole, with the same kind of idea that a sort of clutch of these will make something sufficiently urban to make it sensible to start talking about it as a city. And even though this is actually a pretty basic and pretty crude way to proceed, it's actually pretty productive. Once you've got this kind of list, first of all, you can start to see that continuity of these features is much, much stronger in Italy than it is in the northern provinces, and it's much, much stronger in North Africa than it is in some of the other southern provinces, which to a certain extent you expect. And the classical paradigm of urbanity continues quite strongly in Italy and Constantinople. But once you're outside of the imperial heartland, this starts falling away very quickly. And in particular in Northern Europe, trade becomes a very, very important criterion of urban settlement, and other things tend to drop away fairly rapidly. Once you've observed that, however, you can also start looking at Italy and start noticing that there are actually urban settlements of a sort of Northern European type that are appearing more often on the peninsula. So you get borghi like Prato or Vigevano, apparently. Which attain a great deal of prominence in the late antique period that they didn't enjoy before, and conform more closely to this kind of northern type of urban settlement. And you can go even further than this, and Wickham does, and start speculating about a general paradigm for urbanism in late antiquity. And he says, actually, part of the problem that cities are having during this period is precisely this criterion bundel. These things all kind of tend to go together integrally in the classical period. If you've got an administrative center, it will tend also to be a commercial hub. It will tend also to have religious institutions, whether pagan or Christian, depending on what you're talking about. It will tend to have judicial functions associated, so on and so forth. What happens in late antiquity is these things start to divide. that these functions get split up and associated with different settlements, and their coincidence tends to be much, much less frequent, and really confined to places like Rome or Constantinople that are huge capitals. So using this kind of crude schema can be tremendously useful and generate new insights, or at least new understandings or syntheses of scholarship that's already existing. What I find interesting about this process that's outlined by Wickham, and I'm sure could be outlined in similar terms in a lot of areas, is that it maps fairly closely onto the kind of research methodology that's recommended and advocated for by the classical scholar Marcel Detienne, who some of you might be familiar with. I think his probably biggest book recently was The Greeks and Us. He also wrote a book called Comparing the Incomparable, which would be pertinent to this discussion. He's a very different scholar from Wickham. He's as much an anthropologist as he is a historian, because he focuses on archaic Greece, i.e. the period when they're moving from a pre-literate culture to a literate culture. And so he's very interested in how you compare Greeks with other pre-literate or transitional cultures in that way. He's much more of a theoretician than Wickham. I have to say he's very French, which will explain why some of the quotes I'm about to show you might come across as a bit clunky. I don't think he translates very well into English. And he's focused on much sort of larger and harder to define kind of ideas. So he's interested in things like democracy, you know, to the extent to which modern democracy can be said to be descended from Greek democracy. He's very interested in the notion of foundation and aitia, which is obviously very important in classical cultures, not so important in modern cultures. What we mean by the term personality, and whether this has got any kind of close analogy in classical texts, and so on and so forth. But Detienne is similar in that he emphasizes the necessity of comparison in the same way that Wickham does, that if you're going to be talking about democracy, it's not enough simply to say, oh, well, we get it from the Athenians, it's the same kind of thing. If you're going to put meat on those bones, you're going to have to make clear exactly what you mean by democracy, and you're probably going to have to do it by looking at other societies that could be conceivably claimed to be democratic. You're going to have to think about medieval Iceland. You're going to have to think about the earlier Germanic tribes, Switzerland's cantonal systems, the Oromo people of Ethiopia, and so on and so forth, before you can start talking about really what you mean when you say that we get democracy from the Greeks. And the way to go about this kind of comparison, according to Detienne, is iterative and experimental, in the same kind of way that I think you see in the scholarship of the urban decline in late antiquity. For Detienne, he says that the hard work needs to go into constructing what it is that's compared. It's not a question of just deciding that two things are the same. You have to work out what's the same and why you think they're the same. So there's the big quote that I don't think translates terribly well into English. The comparativists, i.e. historians and ethnologists, alerted by one or several dissonances between cultures in the term of comparison, proceed to coin a new category or set of concepts as their ideas and questions become more precise. They move constantly from one culture or society to another if these seem of a kind to make the conceptual elements that have been considered discovered productive. They try to see how known cultural systems react not only to the initial category that was selected as a touchstone, but also to the series of questions that now arise and the conceptual elements that gradually come to light. So, you try an idea, you throw it against the cultures that you've got, see what happens, and you keep on repeating this process until you've got some kind of probably fairly loose and baggy concept that will actually serve to describe all of them. And ultimately you end up with some kind of hopefully adequate conceptualization of the term. So again, we have this sense that mediation across times and cultures and periods is this very reflexive kind of procedure. It's not simply a question of looking at the data. It's a question of looking at the data, working out what makes sense to what kind of thoughts you can think about the data, testing them out against the data, modifying the concept that you're using to describe the data, and so on and so forth. And this is not an easy process, not only because of questions of lack of data or fuzzy conceptualizations, but as Detienne points out, it's very often the case that the more difficult it becomes to make this data commensurate, the more fruitful the inquiry is. the Tien writes a lot about dissonances, which is this idea of features that are apparently absent or incredibly banjaxed in one culture that are taken as absolutely natural in another culture. And the question that is raised, of course, is how can it be the case that, that two different groups of people have got such radically different conceptualizations of something? And even though this is all sort of kind of theoretical stuff, I think we see a lot of examples of this actually in classical scholarship. If you look at a lot of writing, it's all about attempts to explain things that the ancient cultures had that we apparently don't, or more frequently, things that we take for granted that you don't really find in the ancient cultures. I mean, the discussion of Greek color terms and more recently Latin color terms has been going on since at least the 19th century because ancient color terms simply don't map very well onto modern color terms. And how you explain this is an interesting question. So there's been a good 150 years of investigation into this. Since the 70s, various people have been looking at questions of the self. I was recently having a discussion with somebody from the Pleiades Project about the extent to which cartography is a sensible category to apply across cultures. To what extent can ancient peoples be said to have been, I think it was odoliterate was the phrase used. De Tien writes about notions of foundation and conversely autochthony, what it means to be from somewhere or claim to be, you know, a native of some particular place. I wrote a whole book about suicide and how the Romans didn't have a conception of suicide that corresponds very strongly to modern Western conceptions of suicide. Ever since Foucault and probably before, there's been a lot of writing about sexuality and homosexuality and the fact that modern and ancient cultures seem to conceptualize these things very differently. So difficulties of mediation between cultures are incredibly productive. The difficulty with this kind of approach to humanities questions, however, this sort of iterative mediating research methodology, is that it's incredibly time consuming. It takes a long, long time. This is, I think, really obvious in Wickham's discussion of the scholarship of antique urban development. There's a definite sense from him that all of this could have happened a lot more quickly and been a lot easier if people had realized that they were talking about different things all along. When an Italian wrote down the word città and a scholar of Anglo-Saxon Britain wrote down the word city, they meant almost completely different things. And a lot of the, many of the difficulties and the questions that arose in this kind of scholarship were kind of spurious because they weren't really about commensurate entities. And you know, I saw this as well writing my thesis on suicide. A lot of the questions that scholars were asking would be the result of having conflated various modern conceptions, particularly martyrdom, with questions of suicide or Roman terms for killing oneself. So you end up with a lot of tail chasing that arises almost purely as a result of terminological confusion. However, even when you're pursuing a more De Tien-like kind of line, and you're starting from a point of view that mediation is important, it's incredibly hard to find mappings across cultures. If you don't have a sense of what you're looking for in the texts of the other culture, what do you have to read in order to find the mapping? Well, the answer would seem to be you have to read everything, which is kind of unfortunate. There are some fields in which this is actually possible, like De Tien's field. I mean, if basically what you have to read is the Homeric epics plus some field reports, you're probably okay with this kind of thing. But as soon as you get to the level of databases, as soon as you've got a quantity of material that demands electronic organization, this is not going to be a practical proposition. So the question becomes, is it possible to technologically deal with this question and speed the process up so that these become answerable questions in some kind of human timescale? The first point is a strictly negative one, precisely because it's the terms of mediation that are at issue and are often the point of interest. It's not possible simply to provide a mediating interface to users. It will not be the case that you can ever just say, well, I've got two databases, I'll stick them together, I'm the database designer, I understand how the schemas work, I'll give them to people like that and expose them in that way. The important point is to let users roll their own. That is going to be the research methodology. Often it might even be considered the research output. This isn't to say that existing ontological mediation technologies are useless, but it does mean that the way to use them is probably going to be to use very, very low-level ontological constructs in order to expose higher-level ontological constructs to the end user. That was probably gibberish to a lot of people, but it becomes a little more obvious if you look at some of the semantic web kind of vocabularies that get used. These are two vocabularies, the simple knowledge organization system, which I mentioned earlier, and something called the web ontology language. And these are just mediating terms that you can use between linguistic terms to specify more closely what you mean and to specify what kind of equivalences you're making. So you've got, you can say one term is broader than another, narrower, you can simply say that they are related in some way, you can try to say how closely you think they're related. You can create lists of things and state that one is a member of the other, or you can specify that one thing is identical to another thing. And I think probably for historiographical database mediation, it's these kinds of constructs that are going to have to be operating underneath the hood. SCOS and OWL are both, by ontological standards, kind of loose and sloppy things, and they allow you to make incredibly irrational and illogical statements. There's nothing to stop you from asserting that miles is a broader term than forum, you know, using these kinds of constructs. But the point is that often the terms that you need to mediate across cultures or regions or periods will not be the ones that you're expecting. You have to give users that kind of freedom in order for the interface to be useful. And they are conceptually pretty simple. I would imagine that most people, maybe with a little bit of syntactic sugar over these, would be able to understand conceptually what was going on when they used these terms. So the challenge is going to be to create some kind of technology that is going to allow users and researchers to specify what they wish to consider to be equivalent classes to things, so that they can say, I am, for the purposes of my research, going to be considering Acuitas the same thing as Amercomonium. Or even that they are going to consider as equivalent all geographic features that meet three or four of the criteria listed in the Kriteriumsbunde that Biddle created. That is going to be a pretty messy kind of thing. There are fortunately tools already existing that can help with this. I'm particularly impressed lately by WordNet. Most of the data stores I've been mentioning do expose their source text in a pretty transparent way, as I said. And this means that natural language processing techniques could be very, very useful in this kind of inquiry. At a minimum, it's got a very important role to play in determining the constellation of meanings that surround a word. It would be good, if you were interested in an Italian database, to be able to see that the constellation of meanings or other words that are strongly associated with the word civitas in Italian source texts is very, very different from the constellation of meanings that surround the word civitas in British source texts. That would be an entirely good thing, and actually fairly straightforward. And if you line this up with WordNet, it becomes incredibly powerful. For those who aren't familiar with WordNet, it's a lexical database, which is a sort of combination of a thesaurus and a dictionary. It groups words together into something it calls synonym sets, i.e. words that it takes to be broadly equivalent, and then defines semantic relationships with other synonym sets. And this is just a small sample of what I think would be the most useful semantic relationships that WordNet uses. So you can determine if you've got an antonym relationship, so you can determine words that are opposed in meaning, hypernym, words that are broader in meaning, narrower in meaning. You've got the entailment specification for verbs, meaning that if you've done one thing, you automatically have to do another thing, so on and so forth. So if you could hook into WordNet, you could conceivably get some very, very powerful semantic information about how commensurate the terms that you're equating actually are. Furthermore, WordNet has been very successfully ported into a number of other languages. I was very surprised to discover that there is a Latin WordNet. There isn't an ancient Greek WordNet, unfortunately. However, some of the techniques that are used by the Latin WordNet people are obviously very clearly portable to ancient Greek. So it would be possible with not little, but a minimum of effort to start developing word nets for lots of languages which are a little bit more interesting to scholars than to the populace at large. So a linguist with a nuanced sense of language and interested in the literary meaning of text would probably find WordNet an incredibly unsatisfactory tool to use. It's kind of like a huge, blunt broadsword in terms of how it classifies word meanings. But it is a quite useful means of hacking through large data sets. Like I say, this is always going to be a sort of iterative process of working out exactly what you mean. And WordNet is very good at this kind of very coarse-grained shoving aside of things that are irrelevant to what you're looking for. I'm sure it would be possible to think of finer-grained tools for subsequent stages of the search, but I think WordNet would be a great place to start. For instance, one possibility that intrigues me is that inherent in the nature of the semantic web is that you can codify and publish the kinds of equivalences that you're making, so that if you were to discover, say, that it was useful to think of a Mercomodium as a kind of Qwitas in connection with your particular scholarly enterprise, it becomes trivial simply to publish that on the web and allow other people to see it, gain access to it, test it, use it, and so on and so forth. So there would be a sense in which it would be possible to crowdsource this kind of rough and ready mediation. However, that is to take an already extremely speculative paper in an even more speculative direction. So I'm going to stop there and leave it over to the floor.
Thank you very much.
I have great problems with data. Mm-hmm.
That is the problem, yes.
Yeah. I know that many of us do. You talked about the late antiquity falling between classics and history, the early bit of a history department. And it is quite interesting in all kinds of ways to see how differently people are thinking about online resources, about all kinds of things, about how the unmatch is indeed really interesting. When I first started working with the inscriptions, everybody said, oh, you want to make a database. And I thought, well, these things are not data. Or, in some sense, they are data. But when you talk about chewing data in all these kinds of ways, you're not just, well, you ended up here. You're talking about chewing text. You're talking about textual analysis. For a hugely large proportion of the evidence which we have. Now, what's gradually happened, it seems to me, is that at last, but really jolly recently, some useful archaeological data is turning up, which they have data which can be called that, I think. You know, here are these pots, and what else can you do with them? But I think that one of the tensions that you're finding comes between this textual, looking at a period through text and the tools you need to do that, and looking at a period through things which change their date every time the archaeologist publishes the next report. So, I mean, they shoot up and down, you know, next year it'll be 100 years earlier or 100 years later. They're very unstable data still. And I wonder whether that's where some of your tensions come, because I'm not sure whether there is a way of putting all that into one thing.
There's a lot of separate points there, I think. I think there's a sense in which we have to, I think, make these things commensurate. And in fact, we do this all the time writing books, right? Mm. I mean, we use natural language to do that all the time and say, okay, well, I'm going to consider the archaeological data in relation to the literary evidence we have and so on and so forth. And that in itself is a tricky thing, regardless of whether or not you're using a computer in there or not. I think with regard to considering texts as data, I think that's right. I think once you start thinking of texts as a big bag of individual words, and or even with sophisticated natural language processing techniques, that's basically what you're doing. I think that is a problem, and I think the kinds of questions you can get answers to looking at text in that way is very different. And I certainly wouldn't say that you want to approach literary texts through this kind of lens primarily. That being said, I think it is probably useful to find, it's a useful means of finding out, first of all, which literary text you might want to be looking at, which is very useful. And I think also there are texts and then there are texts. I mean, if you've got, say, a large number of legal charters or something like that, it's going to be necessary to really hack your way through a lot of them. If you're not interested specifically in legal texts, if you're interested in using that as evidence for something else, you are probably going to have to treat it as a bag of words at some point. Now, when you get to more detailed questions, you are going to want to throw that kind of approach away and actually deal with the primary source as a primary source in its context and stop looking at it as a data collection. But certainly in the initial stages, you're going to have to consider things in that light, I think.
you very carefully.
Yeah, but I think that care is always, I think that's inherent in any time you're asking a question, really. I suppose what's worrying about computers is that they are better at hiding the process by which you're accomplishing that mediation. I mean, in natural language, we've all got tools for parsing out very clearly and easily how that's being done, and obviously there are rhetorical tricks you can use to paper over the cracks. But computers, particularly the people who aren't computer people, do tend to be kind of a sledgehammer approach. But I think really it's a difference of degree rather than kind.
That's about deregulation from the beginning. Because are you envisaging that you could aggregate the data through some markup, or are you envisaging, as you explained it, that they are linear hops, that you go into this pot, you get this stuff, you get a smaller pot, you throw it into the next database, you get more data out? Or is there some more web that you can envisage that could make
interoperability doses? I think, unfortunately, for the long, in the sort of medium term anyway, it's going to always be a mix between those two. I mean, the more and more people are publishing stuff as linked data, which is great, and I think it's probably this kind of thing that would be worth doing retroactively on a lot of data stores that already exist. However, I don't think a lot of organizations are thinking that way, and if, you know, nobody wants to spend time revisiting a database that they've already created. Okay. So I think it would be nice to create a sort of general kind of semantic web interface that would be capable of looking at things that were semantic webized, linked data sets. But I think, unfortunately, for that kind of mediation to take place, it's still going to be a question of looking at individual data stores and working out some kind of individual API for them. Mm.
Stuff, I want you for a plug.
Okay.
as told you here, Natural British Museum is one of those organisations that is publishing its data as big data. But also, we are, or a member of our staff is running a project funded by the Mellon Foundation. We now have a name for Research Space. That will be a space where you can aggregate sets of linked data on a project basis, so you can do it discreetly. You'll have publishing tools so that you can publish what you want to from that. One of the biggest efforts going on is to make it as easy as possible for you to start with any data source in any database and to map it. I think you described it, map it at a high level, using CDoc, CRM.
Oh, okay, right.
Hopefully with the minimum amount of knowledge needed of that to do some mapping early on. There'll be some support to do that. But once the data's in, you can then, within your project, decide how much you want to refine that mapping and what need there is for the mapping, so you don't end up mapping everything that you don't need to. Because it's quite, I mean, it's a great deal of fun to use these same analysis, nearly same analysis, it gets your mental juices going, gets you thinking about things. It can be quite time-consuming and quite argumentative too. So one doesn't want to get sidetracked into that. So it allows you to have the degree of granularity that you need. But this is, the project is, it's out to tender to actually get the mechanical bits of it. So it's beyond the concept now. It's actually going to exist. Because I've been to, I'm sure you all have been to loads of conferences where people have said, you will be able to do this. Hopefully in a year's time we'll have a real tool to be able to bring you and show you, and we'll be able to play with it and see what it can do. But it's going to take a long time, because that's the hardest bit, is actually getting old data sources into even the broadest terms to a point where they can talk to each other. But that will get easier over the years as more and more projects start in this environment and start thinking about that environment.
Sorry, what was the name of the sort of general?
It's called Research Space.
Oh, okay,
one
right.
Word, one word, Research Space. You'll find it if it actually comes up first in Google if you put it in without the gap.
Okay, right.
There's a web page there that will explain the. You'll hear about that in a second. That'll explain the project probably better than I have.
Ah, brilliant. Okay, so all of that was just past tense, basically. Excellent.
To some degree, I'm very much of the opinion that texts are. It's worth It's worth tying them up with thesauri for comparison. You know, it's worth letting a thesauri looking at a text and saying, do I recognize anything in it?
Mm-hmm.
And using it as a way of developing thesauri, but actually breaking text into individual. I mean, you know, the database I'm using at the moment does that naturally. It actually indexes every word in every text. It doesn't. It just doesn't really teach you enough to make it work in storage that it does that, even with NLP. So I think keywording of text is probably a better level of granularity for text. But that's just my own opinion coming from a practical world.
Well, I mean. Yeah. So I think I will sort of mount a slightly stronger defense of treating text as data. Although I think you're right, keywording is probably the useful level of granularity there. But I mean, there is a sense in which treating all text as natural language text does often obscure differences. I mean, this is particularly a problem in history where you've got some words that are technical sometimes, but not necessarily. And you've got a lot of words that aren't technical but probably should be, and all of this is in a kind of nice big stew of standard regular expository writing. And in fact, I think I alluded to this a bit with the history of urban decline question, in which you do have a lot of people arguing furiously that there are no cities in Britain in the 6th century AD, and other people saying, well, of course there are cities, you know, I can point to them on a map. And you know, and of course, with the pace of journal publication and so on and so forth, you can happily have that debate for 20 years. And despite the fact that many historians are also linguists, and certainly most classes as are linguists, the fact that this is really, this whole argument is essentially a linguistic artifact has been easily ignored. So I think, to a certain extent, being able to point to a an NLP cluster and say, this cluster is not that cluster, is probably a useful thing to be able to do.
You also have the problem that you're assuming, when you do a lot of this parsing, that the grammar's right. And grammars have been evolving, and even the Latin grammar has been changing. If you know, people be like, oh, the grammar, the same grammar we use now to write Latin, used in the classical period. It's not. You can chart the changes in thought about grammar, and cases are pulled in and pulled out, and things are changed. And if you're putting a parser on that's going, this is grammar, mm-hmm. you're losing something, because this isn't grammar, this is our view of grammar. And sometimes you want to see what isn't in the grammar, what isn't matching, what isn't working, which is where text as data is very useful to do that. But if you automatically layer all the stuff on, you lose so much, as well as gain different mm-hmm. things.
Although that is actually a problem with thesauri, I mean, not so much with the grammar, but meanings of words, in that, I mean, WordNet, you've got Latin WordNet, which is great, but it's not, you know, it's presumably mostly, well, they've got this kind of weird thing where they take English WordNet and Italian WordNet and intersect them. And so you end up with this extremely schematic view of what the meaning of words actually is. And for late antiquity, you can imagine going badly, badly wrong. You just think, no, I don't think that word meant that anymore at this point. So there's actually a huge weakness there. Now, again, the nice thing about it all being made up with these semantic web constructs is that you could say, I am having my own late antique WordNet. I am going to say that is not that. You know, I'm going to remove it say that it's you know, I can increase the semantic distance that I'm saying it, you know, it exists, but.
But a lot of this semantic web, it loses the authority. So you can create your version, you can create your version, you create your version, you won't have your authority, you won't have your wordness. But how do I know who to trust? How does the computer know which is the better one for the purposes? Because for you, having those different soldiers being the same as your taste is perfect. I mean, that's terrible. I want to see that it's a different word. It's not the same as.
But isn't it comparing different data sets and seeing the differences by which you then are able to come to new definitions, and also that's where the kind of skill comes in, and where you is how you bring them all together to synthesize something that is surely most important. And also, when you're talking about data sets not being so useful for text, they're actually incredibly important for fragments and for assigning to Euripides and looking at Ionic resolutions, it's increasingly more and more important for Bracken's work because we've been learning about this.
Very true, fragment transcriptions, that's where all these word lists are absolutely brilliant. Somebody realised where it all fits together. That's perhaps a rather specialist kind of area.
That's
pretty jolly.
Not just transcriptions, but papyri as well.
Yeah, anything that's in bits.
Yeah.
Can I ask two quick questions? I have actually a third, and that is, you mentioned that people vigorously contradicted to your proposal. I would be very interested in hearing why, so that maybe a bit later.
Hella pop!
For example, it seems to me, and you went in the direction, if I understood you correctly, that these connections, this bridging between the data sets on a conceptual level, is a highly interpretive act. But that, I don't mean subjective, but it is an act that should be queried critically, or at least put into question. And then if you do it on a project level, it might work. But it might be a question for both of you, practically for your project, I guess, would you make those connections available beyond the project?
And you would always publish your work. Well, I mean, the reason that CDoc is quite useful is because it stops where the arguments start. That's what it's been designed to do.
Right.
It's that they have only published, I think it's 90 terms, they're pretty broad level, and they as soon as there started to be arguments about how these things could be conceived, they said, right, we're not going any deeper than that. Because beyond that, each set of requirements can publish their own extensions, and that will be what you will do. You will publish a document that might be called an ontology, if you wish to argue about what an ontology is. But for the purposes of your enterprise, you will publish a document explaining what your extensions have been. And not a lot of this has been done, so it's not really known how that will work. But in a little toe in the water that we've done, we've already started to notice that some extensions crop up again and again.
Right.
Now, it may be that this was definitely the conception that comes from the web, is that a lot of the development won't come from theorizing, but will come from practical use, in the same way as the web developed in that way. But the web started with a very small set of extensions that people then develop new ones to, just from need. And the idea is that extensions to CDoc and other similar definitions will come from people noticing that 99.5% of all people define a date in a certain way, although they all date back
up. Oh,
but certain things do get redefined the same way. I mean, we've got three sets of data, we've noticed one extension that breaks it. But you always publish your extensions.
I'm not entirely sure that the granularity is where disagreements are always, but it's an interesting answer. The other question I have is, I mean, how do you envisage these connections being formalized? In other words, who does it? You get a scenario where, say, well, the people who publish a database, right, should do it. You already said, well, that's very unpopular because, usually that they're paid for by a funding cycle that has come to an end, and maybe if it's well designed, barely left enough to maintain that data set. Is it a researcher who then aggregates and then publishes those connections?
Yeah, I think my thinking about it was it's about the researcher doing it because that's what the researcher is interested in doing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously somebody has to write some kind of interface for it. That's the tricky unfunded bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because really only the researcher has an interest in doing it. I mean, if you publish and curate a data set, I suspect you don't have time nor the inclination to start worrying about what other data sets, might be and what they might be shaped like. What I find interesting is that the sort of hostility I alluded to actually tended to move in completely the opposite direction from the point that Charlotte raised, which is the hostility tended to be actually like, well, if you can't formalize these things in a strictly ontological way, you're dealing with unanswerable questions. So don't talk about them. Like, it tend to be much more kind of, tend to be coming more from the kind of computer science angle, that these kinds of higher level claims are sort of inherently problematic or, yeah, inherently problematic, hard to define. If one culture has got one concept and another culture doesn't, then clearly the concept is unreal. So don't ask the question, like, don't address the concept. That was kind of where the tendency tended to be. So, yeah, so treating text as data was fine. Treating it as anything else was kind of the problematic aspect of it. And I think this is a real problem for digital humanities generally, in that I think the computer science audience tends to view any of these kinds of questions as just simply off the map. You know, they're not interested in the conceptualization, they're interested in the formalization. And the humanities audience tends to be interested in the conceptualization and view the formalization as kind of bean counting. So I think that was where the hostile friction was coming from.
There's a question there.
I was wondering if you thought that there would be a danger that comparative approaches, because start to rely too much on databases, and the fact that because it's such a useful tool to all of us, it is so instinctive to the way we think, that we start, because by making a word a data, you decontextualize it. The semantics that were brought by chronology, like different words can mean different things at different times, or by context, disappear, and a new context appears, which is the database, in which everything is equal and you can compare things, which is useful for comparative approaches. But if you only use that kind of thing, then you can, it's an artificial grammar, as you said. It becomes a decontextualized historically grammar that, and you end up comparing things that could not really be compared, if that's clear.
Well, I think that is a problem. I don't think it's the main problem historians have, because while I was looking at this, what kind of struck me was that anthropologists have got an incredibly huge theory of comparison built up, because, you know, I mean, I suppose this is inherent in their enterprise. So if you read anthropologists on comparison, and in fact Marcel Detienne is sort of half an anthropologist, they are very, very worried about how you make comparisons, and they make very, very fine-grained comparisons, and they always hedge comparisons around with a lot of restrictions. Historians are fantastically bad at making comparisons. They make very large comparisons in very, very broad strokes. It sort of verges on cocktail chit chat. Although it's also the kind of thing you'll hear on sort of the Today program a lot, you know. Oh, the Iraq weapons of mass destruction thing is just like the Catalan conspiracy. That's the kind of comparison that historians tend to make. And so I would say probably the real problem is not the tool in the case of historians. The problem is the kind of habit of thought, and that you get your own little specialization and you get very familiar with it. And amazingly, now that you have this specialization hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I think the real problem is disciplinary, that historians, if they're interested in comparison, have to get better about comparison and start reading what anthropologists have done. I think for an anthropologist, yeah, the dangers of only using database style mediation would be very apparent. But I think by and large that's not the problem that other disciplines have.
Don't you think you're being too considerate? I mean, for the purposes of, like, making this useful, even just promoting it, wouldn't it be better to, I mean, it seems to me like you're building a structure and you're leading it at a point where you start having discussions. We still have conceptions that, you know, you might not see them, but they're ideological, just for now. Wouldn't it be better to just build, like, a completely ideological structure, and then just allow everybody else to change it if they want, but just build the one you think is right.
Yeah, but they still have to have some.
Not have discussion with the neighbor because you're probably going to fight.
Wait, so you sort of create this edifice and people can knock it down, you know, as they will.
Marxist.
No, I think that already happens. Yeah, I mean every data store has a sort of implicit structure to it and an implicit ideology to it. That's right. You're always going to need to have a tool in order to negotiate with that in some way, right? I mean, supposing that you just expose the database as a standard database so that, you know, there's a web interface and the user cannot get behind it in any way. There's no access to the original store, right? Your ideology is very, very clear. All that the user can do is say, well, I don't agree with the way it's structured, and leave it behind. I mean, you're always going to need to have some kind of tool set to deal with it. I mean, and in fact, you know, if you look at something like Marxist historiography, right, again, leaving the computer out of it, the difficulty of dealing with Marxist historiography or something like creation science is that it's such a complete self-contained world that it doesn't give you any hooks into it. You're like, how do I argue with this? You know, the first thing I need is a concept of the bourgeois and the proletarian and class struggle in Hegelian dialectic. And once I've accepted all of those things, I've lost the argument. So I think I don't think that's a very, I suppose my answer is sort of ideologically liberal bourgeois right there. But I don't think building the giant edifice and then saying, you know, enter if you dare is, you know, particularly
no, I mean,
productive.
Offering one as your take on it, but still allowing other people to change.
Oh yeah, well, I suppose I think that's sort of implicit in what I was saying, I think, in that, you know, the data store will have structure. It's really just a question of giving people the tools to muck around with the structure, you know. And I think it's important. I mean, you know, when people talk about ontologies, they always talk about making sure that it's got minimal commitments. I think that's important. You know, you don't want to create some kind of wall or barrier, even, you know, accidentally, that will prevent people from manipulating things as they will. I think that's where the computer science end becomes useful. Ontologists are very, very good at spotting when the kind of subsumption hierarchy you've created is actually going to create all sorts of horrible entailments that will mean people will get a distorted idea of what's going on. So I think that kind of low-level commitment is very important. Past that basic ontological point, I think, free it up and let people muck around.
Is that a bit about where we are at the moment, just going historically, in that we know it'd be lovely if everybody did loads of mashups with our stuff, but we haven't quite got there yet. And when you want to do a mashup, you find that the stuff you want to mix it with hasn't yet been digitized. Bother, I'll have to wait. So we're just at the beginning of what we can do when we take people's stuff and play with it and do something else with it. At the moment, if you mention that to conventional scholars, they look absolutely appalled. The idea of when you say, I'm hoping somebody will take my data and transform it. Why would you want that? You know, I mean, it's quite interesting, but we very much need that to happen in our field to be able to, and then we'll see what works and what sort of ways of matching things up works. But we keep on talking about it as something that's going, it's another of those is going to happen things that turn up at conferences.
I think it's worth saying that about research spaces that we're writing some government documents at the moment, and what we've found is that the technology is secondary, actually. The community is primary.
True of all research projects.
Because it's going to be a communitarian enterprise that you're. The idea is that anyone can take part that wants to, and I mean there'll be a kind of project gateway that if you want someone to be involved in a project, there's no payment to get in. Some people will have to pay because there will be need to be some administration, and that's still to be finalised how that's going to work.
Yeah.
But the idea is that actually we want to try and get the best out of scholarly and cultural humanities. Scholarship practice and reflect that in the communities that we build into the system. And hopefully, the technology should be as much in the background as possible. Because I think that's really key, that how people interact. And there must be trust, as a word we keep using. Just keep using the word.
Good luck.
Well, one thing that struck me, actually, is how. This could just be personal predilection, but one thing that struck me is how much friendlier and how much easier the technology has got for this kind of thing. Because, I mean, I recently shifted from working on a lot of database projects, and by which I mean relational database projects. I mean, thinking about relational databases is horrendous, and it takes a real sort of paradigm shift in your head to start visualizing how all these things join up and how you get information out of it and how it's related to each other. And I do find that even though semantic web stuff and semantic web constructs are doing the same job, it's much, much easier to use them in a kind of intuitive and straightforward way than querying a relational database is. Even at the level of interface building, you know, there's about 15 layers on the stack that you have to build between a relational database and some kind of usable user interface into it. Whereas I'd be pretty happy, you know, I wouldn't want to expose that vocabulary completely unmediated to the user, but it would be maybe one or two layers of mediation before I'd be happy letting them go at it. So I do feel like that wall has gotten a little bit thinner.
Could you say the exact opposite of what you said? Probably two, and that is, yes, we don't have the critical mass of digitized data, text, objects, but we do have the means to make connections on a conceptual level, even though, well, the text is not digitized yet, but, you know, Bodleian mask so-and-so, folio so-and-so, it's the same, or it's a translation of, you know.
We're getting very close to it, I mean, but it's just kind of tantalizing, because you keep on thinking, oh, wouldn't that... Oh, no, of course it isn't. It isn't there yet. And, of course, you've got things that are behind tables.
Yeah. Well, that's not too bad.
Not to name any names.
Isn't Juan's point that you can do relational data, you know, define relationships, whether your data is digital or not?
Yeah, true.
Because that's what we do. Yeah. Anyway, that's how we think.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you point to, what URI you put in the second half of your... string, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, ideally you connect the two, right?
Yeah.
You have something you can point to and people can look at it or query it. But I would say, sorry, this is your paper, research. Can you say but for me, the interesting thing of what that might yield in the longer term is less a space where people can do something rather than seeing how people connect and comparing them and seeing patterns. So in other words, using the data that is being generated in that space to do a meta-analysis and say, well, that there seem to be connections that are established in the community between object X and Y, and it seems to be of that kind, 89% and 11% think it's a different kind. And so but that's a different kind of sort of yield than to saying, well, we need a space where people can do it. So anyway,
so two very, very short observations. Yeah, one is the meaning of words change. It's obvious, isn't it? Really, having looked at language analysis with students using small corpora of late 20th century language, vernacular of the 1960s, late 1960s, comparing with a modern vernacular, the words, the meanings and usage of the words completely changes. So to have the flexibility in your organization of the different terms that you use just makes complete sense to me. And I guess it's going back to my days as a student, and it's probably one of the struggles I had with learning languages. Sorry, that's between him and I. But the other thing is also just another slight point. Prosopography of the Byzantine Empire, there's also prosopography of the Byzantine world in amongst your data sets, which is available online. And some people in this room worked on.
Oh yeah, it's just a little later than I was thinking of. I would have loved.
But it encompasses the same data set, no?
No, it's maybe it's too late for this.
Okay. That's my error then. I thought
maybe is its parent.
Yeah.
And we haven't yet got it online, but you know, watch this space.
Okay.
And it's very different, isn't it, in terms of what it, because it's sort of, it's a bit more like a print prosopography, isn't it?
There's a quite an interesting evolution that you can see from something that started in print in the 19th century to online in the 21st, and how difficult it is when you have something like that, when the genes are there. It's very, very difficult to recognize that you're now in the new medium.
Yeah, my understanding was that it was sort of, putting it maybe slightly invisibly, but a bit of a mule in a sense.
Oh, yeah, well, it's steady, it's a whole series of mules, it's gradually morphing.
All right, okay.
Any final question?
I just have a different kind of question. So if you could clone yourself and and therefore spend 3 years doing a bunch of work that you've already done, and so say you were going to do your dissertation on Roman suicide all over again, but using this methodology instead of the traditional methodology, presumably, that you did use, how do you think that would affect the outcomes of your research?
I think I was fortunate. I think probably in this case it wouldn't change it that much because I was fortunate enough to have had a predecessor who essentially did all the database work. In the sense that he created huge tables of everything, except in print form, and listed what he thought of as every incident of Roman suicide with textual citation to support. So in a sense, I feel like I already actually did this process. And in fact, I think what I was describing in a sense in the back of my mind was that this was in fact the process I'd gone through with my thesis. So in a sense, what I did was go through him, read through it and say, well, actually, I'm not talking about these 15 things that he's cited. And through a process of further reading, decided that I was talking about 15 things that he had mentioned. So I suppose really it would have been the same kind of thing, except done through a screen rather than on paper. I think actually, now that I think of it, I think the shortcoming here, as Charlotte kind of alluded to, is a question of broad context, in that semantically concerns about the kind of suicide that I was interested in and that is actually closest to modern conceptions of suicide in Roman texts is always concerned with honor, you know, which is a Latin word that actually maps pretty closely onto the English version. I would be surprised if that word actually occurs very often in those passages. There'll be a lot of synonyms for it, actually, so that's where something like Latin WordNet would come in handy. But it certainly wouldn't be apparent at first glance that was the issue. I can imagine discovering that using WordNet, realizing that there was, you know, that a lot of the words connected to it were in the syn set that also held the word honor, and that this is a word that is convenient to use in English. But you'd have to be a pretty skilled user. Actually, I don't think it would be a question of simply being guided to it by the interface. So, you know.
I mean, that then obviously suggests that we're not doing a completely new kind of research.
No, that I think
tools into what we're doing anyway. Which
no, that's right. I think this is absolutely standard. Yeah. This is an absolutely standard. I mean, this is sort of why I gave this list. Mm. And I think this is the other reason I had some hostile reactions is that there are. In fact, there are a lot of scholars who are sort of ideologically committed to the idea that we are genetic inheritors of, you know, the classical tradition in some sense. And so saying, well, actually, they didn't have that kind of concept is a bad thing to do. Or as I discovered in my thesis, what happened a lot with my thesis was that I would say, oh, I work on suicide. And the person, my interlocutor, would say, oh, that sounds very depressing. And I'd say, no. In our text, it's always a party. I mean, when you commit suicide, you invite everyone around. And you deliver a noble discourse on the nature of the soul and the immortality of noble ideas, and then your Greek physician slashes your wrists and you die. It's great. It's fun. And they would say, oh, well, that's not really what happened. Yeah. And it was a surprisingly common reaction amongst, you know, educated people. I mean, this wasn't just, you know, undergraduates who were saying this to me. So there is a huge sort of basic assumption in amongst a lot of scholars that things are fundamentally the same. And I think that was kind of why a lot of hostility emerged. But I think, in point of fact, there's large areas of scholarship that do conform exactly to this model. And it's really a question of, you know, if we're going to be using electronic tools to store the data, can we use electronic tools to apply this method of scholarship?
I think we've come to the formal conclusion. But thank you very much, Timothy.